Welcome to a very special 58th edition of the FDH Lounge on SportsTalkNetwork.com. You can join the show where nothing is off topic by phone at 216-658-0042 or toll free 866-789-4786 or by email at studio@SportsTalkNetwork.com. Now let's join the FDH Lounge dignitaries. At the studios of SportsTalkNetwork.com as we broadcast worldwide from the gleaming shores of America's North Coast. Whether you are listening in an igloo in Iceland, whether you are listening via dial-up on a dingy desktop in Detroit, whether you are listening via satellite in Cyprus, we welcome you to the Great American Radio Show, albeit on internet television. This is, of course, program number 58 for the FDH Lounge, a production of FantasyDraftHelp.com and FDH Enterprises, LLC. And we have a very special program here this evening. Glad to welcome you in here. Rick Morris, Eric Stranka with you, the dignitaries that are in for tonight. And we have a gentleman that we were very, very pleased to be able to book for this program here this evening. Currently promoting his new book, and I have an electronic copy of the book. The publisher was kind enough to furnish that for me. It's selling out so fast, apparently they weren't able to ship a hard copy. So that shows you how fast it's going, but the publisher was very, very agreeable to send me an electronic copy. I do have, and we'll get this on camera here at some point tonight, I do have a picture of the book jacket. It's Priceless Memories, and it's written by the one and only Bob Barker. It is my pleasure to say, Bob Barker, come on down to the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the program tonight, sir.
Thank you, Rick. Thank you very much.
It's our pleasure to have you. This is the show, truly, where nothing is off topic, and I was so pleased to find out that we had you booked as part of your tour right now with this book. And I'd like to start by mentioning something that you said in your book very early on in there, because it backs up an observation that I had, and that is that you get approached constantly, especially by younger people, about the Happy Gilmore movie and about that. And I have to tell you, Bob, when I was telling friends and family when we first got this book that you were going to be on tonight, most of my friends, the first thing they did, whether by text or phone or whatever, was start quoting me Happy Gilmore. So anecdotally, it's the same thing you're talking about there. That had to be a weird thing. I know you said in the book that it kind of came out of the blue. And here's this thing that just really hit the younger part of popular culture, such that you're getting asked about it to this day. Talk about what that was like for you.
Well, it all began with Adam Sandler. Adam had watched Price is Right ever since he was a kid. And he wrote that part of the picture, and he didn't tell me he was doing it, but he sent it to me. And when I saw that I won the fight, I said, man, I'll do it. Because I had been studying karate with Chuck Norris for years, and Chuck would come over to my house and beat me up twice a week, and I'd never won a fight. So I said, if I'm going to win this fight, I'll do that. And we did it about 1994, I think, and I never taped A Price is Right. Once that movie was in the theaters, I never taped A Price is Right that the audience didn't want to talk about Happy Gilmore, and particularly young men. They loved that picture. They'd ask me, can you really beat up Adam Sandler? Could you beat up Adam Sandler in real life? And I'd tell him, are you kidding? Adam Sandler couldn't whip Regis Philbin.
Well, you know, one of the beauties of YouTube, Bob, I saw this on there, with the episode of The Price is Right, where you came out with a cast on your hand. That was pretty good, too.
Yes, that was. I had a lot of injuries on Price is Right. It was a dangerous job.
Uh-huh. I loved your explanation about how you had just been mixing it up with Adam Sandler there, and I think the audience got a big kick out of it. And of course, in the course of promoting this book recently here, you found yourself back on The Price is Right, albeit in a completely different role, as somebody who was more of a participant in the show this time around rather than the host. I'm sure that had to be just, you know, an unbelievable experience for you. It's something that, of course, in our flagship city of Cleveland, Ohio, here for the Sports Talk Network, it's one of our local sons who took over for you in the form of Drew Carey. So
that's right. He's from Cleveland.
Yes. So we were watching that with a particular interest in this city, but I'm sure getting back on the show in that role and everything like that, it seemed from the clips that I watched of it that you were really touched by the reaction that you got.
I really was. I was indeed. The audience reaction was just terrific, but I was also touched by the reaction of the crew and the technicians. And with the fellows in electric, when I stepped in to CBS there, there's a long hallway with studios on both sides of the hallway. And at the end of the hallway, where you couldn't miss it, the fellows in electric had put up a sign in light bulbs that said, "Welcome back, Bob." And it really brought a lump to my throat. I thoroughly enjoyed my visit, and that book plug was the most monstrous book plug in literary history, I think. I was on the show for about 10 minutes in those two showcases, and we were giving away books and plugging the book throughout. It was just a wonderful experience all the way around.
Well, and something I'd like to ask you about the book itself, and as far as your philosophy about writing the book, because I in the course of getting ready for this, I read some other interviews that you'd done. Something that really kind of struck me is that it wasn't really your typical celebrity book in a lot of ways, because, again, when you look at the span of your life, it seems as though probably about maybe the first half of it or so, roughly, was lived in a time in this country before we really had such, you know, coarsening that we've had of the modern culture here. And in recent decades, celebrity books have tended to settle on, you know, the salacious, settling scores, you know, things like that. Your book, and it wasn't like a preachy kind of a thing, but it was like kind of an upbeat positivity to it. You're just going to tell things kind of like they are, and you didn't really delve into any of that stuff. And I found it personally kind of refreshing to see a celebrity book that didn't seem to need to go out of its way to try to sell copies. You seemed to be confident enough in yourself that you were going to sell copies without having to resort to any of that.
Well, I tell you, you're a very discerning fellow. I made every effort. I decided when I first started writing the book that everything that I have done on television has been fun. Truth or Consequences was a fun show. Price is Right was a fun show. Even my specials and my guest appearances, they were all on shows that were happy shows. And I wanted to write a happy book. And that's what I tried to do. I wanted to make it conversational, which I've been told I certainly did. And if you look through the book carefully, you'll realize that I did not say anything derogatory about anybody. As you said, it was not a typical Hollywood tell-all type book.
No, that was very clear, definitely. I mean, as I flipped through it there, and it was just something I noticed all the way through, and these are things that normally you wouldn't have to flip that far into a Hollywood or celebrity book to find. I have to ask you, Bob, with the very coincidental occasion of you appearing on our show on this very day, when one of the big headlines is Michael Vick getting released from prison today, of course, this book was being written with proceeds from it going towards animal rights groups. You've been very active in that. You detail in great length in the book all of the various foundations that you've been associated with. You go into explicit detail about your involvement in this, which I think people already kind of knew about with you already and with the sign off that you did every day, but you go into much greater detail about it. Surely you would be somebody who's got some very relevant thoughts here on Michael Vick and the amount of acceptance into society that he should get after some of the crimes he's committed.
I'll be happy to tell you how I feel about Michael Vick. But first, I want to enlarge just a bit on the profits from the book. The profits from the book will go to the DJ&T Foundation, and it subsidizes spay-neuters for dogs all over the United States. Now, having said that, back to Michael Vick. For him to become involved in something so horrific as dog fighting is just hard for me to conceive. Here he is, a splendid athlete with all that God-given talent and making tons of money. He could do and buy anything he wants. Why he had to become interested in dog fighting, I don't know. And to promote it and profit from it is just horrendous. Now, inadvertently, he has done a great thing for the anti-dogfighting campaign, because dogfighting is all over this country. It can be next door to you, and you may not know it. And the laws are there. They're on the books in most states, pretty stringent laws, but they're not enforced the way they should be. And dogfighting is not reported as much as it should be. However, that has changed thanks to Michael Vick. His whole story was all over the media, as you well know. And people who didn't even realize there was dogfighting came to terms with the fact that not only was there dogfighting, it is rampant throughout the country and was in the process of becoming worse. Now, I think it may be slowing down a bit now, because I'm told that more and more reports are coming into the various law enforcement agencies, and I'm told that there are more arrests made and more prosecutions. So, inadvertently, Vic did help the anti-dogfighting campaign. That's the only positive thing to come out of this whole fiasco.
Well, that's true. He certainly did shine a spotlight on the issue of it, and that obviously wasn't his deliberate intent. But that's as you're right about that. That's how it played out. I have to say also too, just to ask you about, in the course of your animal rights activism, what are some of the more horrific things that you've come across? As I've been soliciting questions from some of our fellow panelists for this show, some of our contributors, one of them put forth to me the notion of the baby seal clubbing in Canada as being one of the worst things he'd come across. This is a gentleman who was himself an animal rights activist. How does something like that, as shocking as that is to the conscience, how does that rate on the scale of some of the things you've heard? Are there things you've come across that are actually worse than clubbing baby seals?
Well, the man with whom you spoke is right on. I have never been up there for the clubbing of the baby seals, been on the scene, but I've seen pictures and films of it, and it is just absolutely heart-wrenching, and it is one of the worst things we have. But there's animal exploitation and animal mistreatment comes in all sorts of ghastly forms, and I've worked on a long list of them. And well, I'm in television, which is not too far separated from movies. Well, television and in movies, but movies much more so. Animals are viciously mistreated in the production of movies. I helped in the expose of Project X, where they were just beating chimpanzees to make them perform in the way they wanted them to perform. But they abuse horses. I worked on the expose of Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman. And thanks to the producer of that picture, Gordon, I believe her name was Gordon, she herself entered in to the, they were not prosecuted, but in the firing of one of the men who was handling the horses, and certainly helped to straighten it out once she learned about it. And but mistreatment of animals in entertainment, period, not just television and movies, is circuses. Oh, it's horrible, the things that go on in circuses, particularly with elephants, and rodeos. Of course, rodeos, they mistreat those horses terribly, and calves, and cows, and bulls. They mistreat animals, and it always, in vivisection, animal research, they mistreat the fur industry. If you remember, years ago, I was in the midst of the fur flap when I resigned from the beauty pageants. All of this, and all of this animal exploitation, if you dig deeply enough, you find it all comes back to greed. Somebody is making a lot of money out of it, and it's hard to get those people to cease and desist. But we've made great strides in the last quarter of a century or more. We've made great strides.
That's true. That's true. There really wasn't as visible of a lobby, really, but before the point in time when you became associated with it. There have been a number of things over the course of the last 25 years or so, your activism being one of those, that's really kind of raised that up on there. Something that you touched on just kind of briefly among the list of things against animals here, but you mentioned it a little bit in your book as well, the subject of animal experimentation, anything that could potentially go towards medicine, towards curing diseases, whatever. That's the one thing where probably people might find that to be in some ways kind of a nuanced type of an issue, agree to disagree, whatever. You seem to be pretty strongly on the side, as you are on all of the animal rights issues, on the side that basically what they're doing is wrong and that it seems unjustifiable. I don't want to put any words in your mouth, but that's the impression I got from your book.
Well, I am on the side of the animals in all of these cases. I truly am. We are the voice for the voiceless, and they need all the help we can give them. And on the subject of animal research, we've made great strides there, too. And as a matter of fact, there are more and more doctors, medical doctors, coming out of the closet and pointing out that the gains from animal research are actually minuscule, and in some cases have set science back, because will make us just choose some a rabbit. They use rabbits a lot, or mice. What may injure or make ill a rat or a mouse or a rabbit, or even kill, might not have an effect at all on human beings. It's hard to use the experiment done on animals to transpose it to the human being. In fact, until it's been used on a human being, they never know how a situation is going to turn out. And the researchers, they call it research, research welfare.
Okay.
The researchers at the university I won't name any specific one, but let's say in Pennsylvania they're doing one thing, and in Arizona they're doing the same thing, and in South Dakota they're doing the same thing, and all over the country, they are so redundant. They do these things over and over and over simply because it's easy to get federal money for these research projects.
Yeah, well, Uncle Sam oftentimes is a sucker when it comes to dispensing money. It doesn't surprise me that the medical research industry would not be an exception to that. I have to say, Bob, you know, that was the question that I raised about animal rights came from one of our more high-minded contributors to the program here. Another question from one of our contributors, a little bit less so, a gentleman who I might, you know, charitably call having a grifter's mentality. He asked me to ask you about the wheel. Is there a way to game that thing? Do you think, I don't even know if you would necessarily know this or not, you obviously had to get the big wheel to go around once there, and I'm sure people tried to make it stop on a dime. In your estimation, was there a way for anybody to be able to game that if they could figure it out just right?
No. There are things to do, you know, to decide whether you should stay or not, perhaps. I know that some... In colleges and universities, we had various mathematics departments that worked on the wheel, and they had some theories. The wheel itself, I might point out, was adjustable, and they tried to get it at just the right spot, but marked just the right mark for the spinning. But if they got it too loose, it spun too long, it went too many times. If they got it too tight, then it was pretty hard to spin it, and that might surprise somebody who got up to spin the wheel, but I don't think anyone could ever know. There was no certain way to win on the wheel.
Yeah, that's. I think that's the impression that most people would have, but I figured it was definitely worth asking. I want to ask you also, too, about, you know, some of the fun anecdotes that are in this book as we continue to give people a sense of what is in your new book, Priceless Memories. I'm sorry, Priceless Memories, the name of the book, particularly the anecdote about the St. Louis Cardinals. That was one that kind of jumped out at me, your relationship with Whitey Herzog. But it's packed full of these fun little interactions you've had with other various celebrities over the years.
Well, the one with the Cardinals, I grew up on the plains of South Dakota. I grew up on the Rosebud Indian Reservation, as you know. I have that in the book also, and talk about the life up there as a kid. But we played all sports, and I was particularly interested in the St. Louis Cardinals because in the summer, my mother and I would go down and visit my grandmother in Springfield, Missouri, and it was a farm club of the St. Louis Cardinals. And I became a Cardinal fan, and I dreamed of one day pitching for the St. Louis Cardinals. And I had mentioned this in interviews, and I went to St. Louis to do a show. And I don't know who it was with the Cardinals, but someone there in the office had either heard me talk about that or had read it, and they invited me out to the ballpark. And Whitey Herzog gave me a Cardinal jacket that I still wear, and he gave me a Cardinal bag that I carried until it was in tatters. And Whitey signed me to a contract, and I get $1 a year from the Cardinals so long as I do not pitch. Whitey said if he heard that I was warming up, the contract was null and void. But in this book, I, as you said, I tell anecdotes from all the shows that I've done and things that happened to me when I was in the Navy and all throughout my life that I hope will cause you to smile here and there and maybe even laugh out loud a few times.
I think that definitely would be the case for people. And I have to say, too, that, you know, the book, it was a lot of fun to read. And it was something that, you know, I'm sure was a labor of love for you that once you were able to retire from the show and put the time into doing it, it's obvious that it was time well spent. And, of course, as you said, proceeds going to the DJ&T Foundation. We always like, Bob, on this show to give our guests a chance to plug, you know, anything. So you've got the book, you've got Priceless Memories, you've got the proceeds going to the DJ&T Foundation. You spoke in the book also of other foundations that you've worked with. Anything else that you'd like to get out there for the people, please take this opportunity.
Well, as I say in the book, the person I have probably worked most closely with in the last quarter of a century in the animal work is Nancy Burnett. And she is the founder and director of a group called United Activists for Animal Rights. They're headquartered in Riverside, California, but she works on projects all over the country. And she doesn't get the publicity she really deserves or the credit that she really deserves, as I pointed out in the book. And I'd like to just throw in the fact that she is one of our country's top animal rights activists and certainly one of the most productive. And beyond that, I think you've covered things pretty nicely, and I appreciate this opportunity to talk about the book.
Well, Bob, it's been our pleasure, and I have to say, too, that you know we cover a lot of ground on this show. We take pride in our phrase that nothing is off topic. We talk anything and everything. But I have to say that in going down our guest roster over time, in terms of telling any friends or family or anybody else who's going to be on this week, I think this is the first time I haven't had to put a qualifier on it to anybody, like to explain to anybody, oh, this guy's from ESPN. Oh, this guy's a drummer in a big rock group. Bob Barker, enough said. And it was a pleasure to have you on, and I tell you, you know, it would be a pleasure to have you back at some point in the future if you've got any more stuff you'd like to talk about with the DJ&T Foundation, any subsequent projects that you have that would put you back out on the media trail, Bob, we would be honored to have you back on.
Well, I've enjoyed the visit very, very much, Rick, and you just give me a call, and we'll get together again sometime.
Oh, that'd be great. Thank you so much, Bob. And please thank your management for us. It was a pleasure dealing with them. So that was great. All right.
Thank you. I wish you well.
Thank you, sir. Same to you. Bob Barker, everybody. I can't believe I'm actually saying that. Bob Barker on the FDH Lounge. And it was just a pleasure to have him on here for this opening segment. We actually did the option of foregoing our opening statements here, which we will do once we get back in. Yes, Paul Belfi appearing. Aaron, thank you. And trust me, the part where I was called a discerning fellow is going in all the new promos for the show.